From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Do we need to be scared straight on climate change? I'm Leon Krause, in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. It's now been a month since President Trump said he would withdraw America from the Paris Climate Accord. Now, a story by New York Magazine has taken the debate about the dangers of global warming to an unlikely boiling point. The report paints a picture of unbreathable air and food shortages. More than 2 million people have read the doomsday warnings, but some scientists call it dangerous alarmism. Others call it not scary enough. We will find out why. And later on today's Talking Point, Trump's big, beautiful border wall is looking more like a 700-mile fence with solar panels, if it ever happens. But first, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Leon Krause, in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. Maybe you are one of the 2 million people who have read or shared the recent New York Magazine cover story, which theirs imagine an uninhabitable Earth. Maybe you liked it. Maybe you found it unhelpful or excessive. Is it an exercise in journalistic alarmism or necessary scientific awareness? On today's Talking Point.
Build that wall. Build that wall. Build that wall.
During the campaign, Donald Trump never wavered on his promise to build a 2,000-mile border wall. Now the president says it could be a much smaller fence with solar panels. It might even be transparent. We'll check in on the design process. But first, this news update. Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with that Russian lawyer dominated headlines all week. Now, another twist. A former Soviet counterintelligence officer by the name of Rinat Akhmetshin attended that Trump Tower meeting. Also reported this week the death of a Republican operative who tried to obtain Hillary Clinton's email from Russian hackers. It's being treated as a suicide. Where do we start? Let's ask an expert. Shane Harris is a senior writer for the Wall Street Journal. He specializes in national security. Shane, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Shane, what do we know about Mr. Akhmetshin, about this ex-Soviet counterintelligence officer, and what his role was in this meeting?
Well, he is definitely a name that is familiar to people who cover areas of Russian influence and lobbying-related issues in Washington. He's been described as a former military counterintelligence officer. In this case, we understand that he was lobbying on behalf of something called the Magnitsky Act, which is an act that sanctions Russian individuals who've been accused of human rights violations. There's actually a great story I point your readers to in the Daily Beast this afternoon that in court papers filed with the New York Supreme Court in November of 2015, he was accused of having been involved in hacking of two computer systems and stealing confidential materials as part of a smear campaign against a Russian mining company.
Accused of an actual international hacking conspiracy, right?
Correct. That's right. Yeah, these are allegations in the State Court of New York in a case that he was named in there. Certainly someone who has longstanding ties to Russian and, we believe, Soviet intelligence. And as I said, is a name that people who cover this area in Washington have come across. So when I saw that he was at this meeting, it was both in some respects unsurprising to me, but in many ways elevated the significance of that meeting because this is not just a kind of a small operator. He's somebody who's a known quantity.
Donald Trump Jr. did not disclose this person's presence in the meeting. This is now the fifth time, at least, he's been caught in some sort of omission or inaccuracy regarding the meeting. Shane, does this make things worse for him?
I think it does, and it wouldn't surprise me, frankly, if the story kept changing because it's changed so many times so far. We've gone from it was a meeting about adoption to it was a meeting that he was attached to this promise of information about Hillary Clinton to now this other person being involved in it. I mean, the White House is really struggling at this point, I think, to try and, number one, insulate the president himself from this. Everyone is trying to be very clear that he did not know the meeting was happening because that would obviously elevate it significantly in seriousness. But they don't seem to be able, in the case of Don Trump Jr., to really get all of the facts out there. And they're coming in these pretty astonishing developments. It would not surprise me if we found out there were more people in that meeting.
And what about Jared Kushner? He still has that security clearance.
He does, and he continues to update the forms to get that clearance, where you have to disclose meetings with foreign individuals so that the people processing your clearance and doing the interviews and the background checks and all that know who you've been in touch with, who might be able to compromise you. The bottom line for why Jared Kushner probably still has a security clearance is the president, his father-in-law, wants him to have one.
Of course.
And under our system, the president can give a clearance to effectively almost anyone that he wants.
Now, this is not the only story related to the Russia scandal. We also learned, like I said, that Peter Smith, this former Republican operative who said he made an attempt independent from the Trump campaign to work with Russian hackers to retrieve emails from a private server used by Mrs. Clinton, committed suicide in May. Shane, you broke that initial story. What's your reaction to what happened to Mr. Smith?
Well, I was I'm quite stunned. I mean, I was stunned to find out that he originally that he had died about 10 days after I interviewed him and before our story came out, and we were unable to determine his cause of death. So now to hear that it was a suicide is surprising. I did not know that he was ill or contemplating suicide in any way. It's of course very sad, and does add some element to the mystery and the kind of the bizarre story of his life, as we understand it from police records. He checked into a hotel across from the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota and was found with a bag over his head and a helium tank and a hose attached under the bed. So he appeared to have asphyxiated himself by inhaling helium in the hotel room.
And he left quite an odd suicide note, right?
Yes, he did. The police report says he left a note in which it says no foul play. Perhaps he was anticipating that people might think that there was some. He was involved, obviously, in some controversial efforts. He also said that he had his health had taken a turn for the worse and that he had a life insurance policy that was set to expire. So the suicide note, as police have described it, appears to try and give some indication to people who would find him that, look, I had other reasons for doing this, no foul play here. And I was not in great health.
Well, with this Russia story, there's always next week. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Shane.
And my pleasure. Thanks.
That was Shane Harris with The Wall Street Journal. In a moment, debating catastrophic scenarios on climate change. Alarmism or much-needed awareness? This is To The Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
I'm Leon Krause, in for Warren Only, back with To The Point. It is, I promise, worse than you think. If your anxiety about global warming is dominated by fears of sea level rise, you are barely scratching the surface of what terrors are possible. That is from this week's cover story in New York Magazine, which has been read by over 2 million people and shared 640,000 times from the magazine's website. Some say that this story does nothing but feed hopelessness on the topic or around the topic, while others think it's just what the debate needed, a dramatic wake-up call. David Wallace Wells wrote The Uninhabitable Earth. He is deputy editor at the New York Magazine, and we welcome him to the program. David, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So
really excited to talk about the piece.
You paint a truly bleak picture of the planet's possible future: diseases, starvation, dehydration, forced migration, armed conflict. Oof, the list is long. Why did you choose this particular approach for this story?
Well, my basic perception as a kind of amateur but close observer of climate science over the last couple of years was that the public was more or less familiar with what's become the kind of conventional or median projection for where climate change will take us over the next century. Scientists think that that's about 2, maybe 2.5 degrees of Celsius warming, which would be really bad, would cause an enormous amount of problems with flooded and drowned cities and probably millions, if not tens of millions, of climate refugees.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think that most people quite understood that that was really the median outcome, and that meant that fully half of the possible outcomes lay on the far side of that mark. I also didn't really believe that most lay people understood how much more was at stake besides sea level rise. The public has really, I think, grasped the threat of sea level rise, but there are many, many more things that climate change will bring about, some of them much more quickly than sea level rise, because a lot of the effects in the sea are about melting ice, and that can take centuries.
Mm-hmm.
So my hope in writing the story was to think a bit about what are our worst case scenarios. I took the UN. The UN has a body, it's sort of an organization that is formed and unformed and reformed, but a kind of running organization that takes surveys of the science of climate change every few years. It's called the IPCC. And they have what's called a business as usual emission scenario. That is to say, what will happen if we do not take any action to curb emissions. And I took their median projection for how much warming that scenario would bring about by the end of the 21st century and their high-end projection. And I took it to a bunch of scientists in particular subfields and asked them what those warming levels would mean for them if we got to 4 or 6 or 8 degrees of warming rather than just the, say, 2 or 3 that most people are familiar with.
Yes.
And then I more or less printed their responses in a certain way. There's a lot of, there's a lot of writerly flourishing in this article, but at a sort of factual level, I think of it as something like a review of the literature.
So you didn't find those worst case scenarios to be, let's say, remote, unlikely. You discovered that they are not that unlikely at all. Am I right?
I would actually say that they are quite unlikely. I think that
they are.
I don't think that we're going to get to the year 2100 without taking any action to curb emissions, in part because I think a lot of these effects are going to become clearer to all of us soon, and inaction will just be impossible. I do think that we've been a little too complacent to this point in thinking that we had more time than we truly do have to take action.
So you wanted, did you want to shock the reader into awareness?
I would say that was one of my hopes, although really my primary impulse was as a journalist to bring news from the science to readers who are unfamiliar with it about what was possible. I didn't really think that most of my readers, and certainly the people that I know in my everyday life, quite understood what scientists were finding about the sort of tail risk scenarios that that should really terrify us all.
David, let me bring in Robert Kopp. He's a climate scientist and professor and director of Rutgers University's Institute of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. Bob, thank you for joining us. Let me ask you this. The main premise of David's piece is, and I quote, "Absent a significant adjustment to how billions of humans conduct their lives, parts of the Earth will likely become close to uninhabitable and other parts horrifically inhospitable as soon as the end of this century." Do you disagree with that premise, Bob?
Well, so coming at this from a scientific perspective, I think a lot of it really depends on those writerly flourishes which David mentioned. I mean, the fact is there are tail risk scenarios. He raises a very important point about the effects of heat and humidity, which I agree is underappreciated. For example, we've done some work just looking at the United States, and we find that under that sort of what David's calling business as usual, I would call a burn a lot of fossil fuel scenario, because I think we're moving away from it. But under that situation, by the end of the century, about a third of the U.S. population would be expected to experience a day or more of record-breaking, extraordinarily dangerous heat and humidity combinations in which an hour of activity outside could lead to heat stroke. So that's a very important risk that was raised awareness of in the article. That said, reading the article, I think a lot of the readers are not going to take away that this is a tail risk, that a lot of these things are only going to happen if both we are very foolish with our emissions and quite unlucky with our physics. And I think that's much of the elements of what the scientific community was reacting to.
So there's a sense of hopelessness that should be avoided.
Yeah, absolutely. I am not hopeless at all. I think we have a lot of potential to significantly reduce these risks. And, you know, every ton of carbon dioxide we emit into the atmosphere raises the temperature of a planet a little bit. Every little bit of temperature increase creates more risks and creates potential for surprises. So, you know, all of the actions we're taking to try to get off of that fossil fuel intensive trajectory are really important.
Following the reactions to David's story, I found basically two different reactions. First, people should remain hopeful, like Robert Kopp says, and some other people who say, no, actually, we should be very scared into awareness. Susan Matthews is of the latter camp. She's a science editor at Slate. Susan, you've argued that alarmism is exactly what people need, that we actually could benefit from being scared, really scared about what might happen. How so, Susan?
Well, I think that we need to be alarmed about something that is extremely alarming. When you talk about alarmism and whether it's warranted or not, I think that that depends on what the likelihood of the situation is. And there's a very real, if small, possibility that this is something that could happen. I think that when you talk about hopelessness, what has happened in the green community specifically is that when we look at and we talk about carbon emissions, and we talk about reducing them, we've gotten to a place where we really feel that that's a personal and an individual responsibility. And so people feel like they have to reduce their meat intake or not drive in cars or not fly in planes. And I understand why people would read something like this and feel scared and feel like they need to make dramatic changes to their lives in order to avoid this kind of scenario. I don't think that that's the kind of alarmism that was the intention of this piece. And I think that if we're looking at how are we going to avoid getting to this scenario, what we need is we don't need individuals to make these sacrifices. What we need is a massive, concerted, systemic change to how we live our lives and how we live on this planet. It's a political question of how we're going to address this. And so when you look at, are we alarmed enough? I don't need to alarm people into giving up into changing how much meat that they eat. What I'd really like is for people to look at this and say, huh, this is something that I need to address, and this is something that we need to address together as a society. And that becomes a political question, and you need to make it a political priority. In the last election, there was never a question about climate change even asked during the debates. And the fact that we're not talking about this in the way that we have the biggest hope of addressing it, that's the problem that I think we need to be alarmed into realizing we need to be doing more.
That's Susan Matthews, science editor at Slate. Yesterday, I had a chance, David Wallace Wells, of seeing the new documentary by Al Gore, the sequel to An Inconvenient Truth. And Gore says that before we can fix the climate crisis, we must find a way to fix the democracy crisis. Do you agree? Is politics indeed conspiring against the planet, at least in the United States?
Well, I think that American politics has been gridlocked in some really unproductive ways on climate. We saw even with a president who is broadly sympathetic to the cause of climate change, with Barack Obama, he was basically unable to take dramatic action on climate, even though it had been one of the central parts of his original campaign. And I just want to reiterate what Susan said. You know, it's a real shame. In 2008, Barack Obama ran on climate change. Cap and trade was part of John McCain's campaign. And even in just 8 years, that possibility for cooperation and action through politics seems to have completely disappeared from the American political landscape. And, you know, there are some other options. I mentioned in my piece that there's a lawsuit being brought by, it's a collective lawsuit being brought on behalf of America's youth and our future generations. I mentioned in my piece in connection to James Hansen, who's one of the central scientists involved in the lawsuit. And it basically alleges that American complicity in the problem of climate change is imposing an undue burden on future generations and is therefore a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And that has been, will be heard in district court in February, I believe, in Oregon. And Jim, I know, is very confident that they'll win there. And if they win there, then it'll go to the Supreme Court. And that could force the government to take action that the legislature hasn't taken. But I just wanted to go back to something that Susan mentioned a second ago, which is, you know, I think it's really important for people to be alarmed about this politically. One of the reasons is that it's not a binary situation. This is not as though we're going to get to everybody dying because it's too hot outside in 2100, or we're going to be fine. All of these effects unfold gradually over time, and all of them get worse the warmer the planet gets. One of my main goals in writing the piece was to establish a worst-case scenario as a kind of psychological anchor for people so that they could really appreciate not just what would happen if we got all the way there, but how bad it would be if we got a third of the way there, if we got a quarter of the way there. And in many of these scenarios, even that would be devastating to the way that we live now. And I think that people really have to understand not just that the stakes are very high, but that all of these effects are not binary. They are fluid.
Bob Kopp, let me ask you, one of the things that one can take away from David's piece is the scientific community's lack of narrative imagination to help convince the public of the dangers of the situation of global warming. Isn't this part of what's happening with the reaction to the piece now, with scientists complaining about alarmism instead of acknowledging the impact the piece has had, the positive impact? I mean, 2 million people have read this thing.
Yeah, and I think it's great that 2 million people have read it. You know, I think, you know, in that regard, I think it's done a great service. Where the scientific community, I think many of the people I've talked to are concerned is just that it sort of fuzzes the edges between science and narrative in a way that's not fully grounded. And I think you can make a very strong case about the importance of considering tail risks, about the importance of heat and humidity, about a number of the points David raises, while staying more tightly within the bounds of, I think, what's well established in the scientific community. We don't need to worry about running out of oxygen to be concerned about people dying of heat and humidity. We don't need to think that climate change is going to make people poorer in absolute terms than they are today in order to be concerned about the very real drag it's going to be putting on the economy.
Susan, briefly, one of the questions David raises is this absence of a sense of urgency when it comes to climate change. And I think that's obvious, maybe not in everyone, but I do see it. I think you would agree. How do you explain that absence of a sense of urgency in the public discourse on climate change? You mentioned politics.
Sure. So I think that there's a lot of literature on this, actually, and climate change is a problem that is kind of uniquely suited to trick and perplex the human brain. It's something that is a long way off. It's something that's really hard to cover in the news day to day. Even today, in the year of 2017, there are heat waves that cause plane groundings and caused deaths, even, that are very, very hard to explain. This is directly the result of climate change. It's really hard to connect those dots.
Sure.
And so people are used to reading this news and used to hearing about it, but there are so many other things that feel much more immediate. And so it constantly gets put off to the end of the to-do list.
We'll come back to the conversation in a few minutes. Later on today's Talking Point, Donald Trump promised a 2,000-mile, 30-feet-tall wall along the country's southern border. That now seems unlikely. This is To The Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing.
Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Leon Krause, in for Warren Only, back with To The Point. Ed Maybach is professor and director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University. Ed, thank you for being with us. Susan Matthews, who's a science editor at Slate, just brought up an interesting point about how people perceive and understand and react to even the idea of climate change. You're an expert on the topic. What can you tell us about it?
Well, we know that most Americans do believe that climate change is happening, and actually most understand that it's human caused, but the average American sees it as a very distant problem, distant in space. They think it's happening somewhere else, not here in their community, distant in time. They think it's happening in the future, not yet, and really, perhaps most importantly, distant in species. They think it's harming polar bears and not people. So all three of these sort of systematic misperceptions undermine the sense that this is that they have skin in the game, that we have skin in the game. And I think that is part of the reason why people lack a sense of urgency, because they see this as a problem that can wait. One of perhaps the most important misperception is they fail to understand a point that a really important point that was made last week in one of the world's leading science journals called Nature. The title of that piece was 3 years to Safeguard Our Climate. And the piece was written by some of the world's leading climate experts who basically make a very strong case that we have only what our best chance to solve the problem comes in the next 3 years. And after that, our chances become more and more remote. So it's this combination of the two factors that really undermines people's sense of urgency.
So in the end, we're talking about how to shake people out of complacency. Would you argue that scaring people on this issue might be counterproductive? Can we count on the narrative of hope and change on this topic, or does literary flourishes and the approach that David has taken with worst case scenarios might actually make a bigger difference?
Well, believe me, a lot of very smart people are studying this exact question. But human beings are complex. We often do things that don't make sense, and any two of us don't necessarily do the same thing in the same ways. So when you look at the research on whether or not fear appeals are helpful, across a whole variety of different warnings that are given in society, from public health warnings to environmental warnings to safety warnings, fear actually does seem to be helpful in motivating people to pay attention. Mm-hmm. But too much fear can be unhelpful. And too much fear in the absence of information that gives people hope, mm-hmm. and gives people a clear sense of what their options are for neutralizing the threat, that can be quite unhelpful. So, you know, fear can be good, and I really give David an enormous amount of credit for getting 2 million people focused on this conversation, and presumably they've been talking about it with a lot of other people in their lives as a result of reading his article. But it's really important that we give those 2 million people a sense of the possibilities for addressing this threat successfully in the next 3 years, and specifically we tell them what they can do to help.
And that's a very interesting angle, David Wallace-Wells. What to do next? We now can see that fear does or can motivate people to be politically active on any given topic. When I share your piece with a bunch of my friends on Facebook and social media, some of them wrote back saying, "I don't want to have kids anymore." Are they exaggerating? I'm sure you've heard this before.
Well, I hope that they're not making those kinds of decisions based on this article.
You're going to be responsible for a downturn on the demographics of the world, man.
I hope that it didn't have that effect, but I do hope that it motivated people to take action and engage politically on climate. Both the comments that were just made, and also I would connect to Susan's comments earlier, which is to say there has been a fair amount of research on how fear affects individual decision making. My understanding is that it's not very clear, but there is some indication that it can be damaging to people's motivation. But I also think that there's, as Susan was saying earlier, there's a whole other level of motivation to think about, which is the collective political level. And mm-hmm. we all know people who failed to give up smoking when they learned how bad smoking was. But collectively, as a country, the fact that we know that smoking is really bad for you has led to all of these laws limiting where you can smoke, all of the taxes that have been very effective in cutting down on new smokers especially, but also getting people off of cigarettes. And so I think that when we talk about the effects of fear, we're often thinking at the level of the anecdote and the individual, but there's a whole other level of information that's important to circulate. And I did say, you know, my piece was not a work of advocacy. It was a work of journalism. But I did say towards the end of the piece that recently there had been a sort of roadmap put out showing exactly what we'd have to do to meet the Paris goals, which, as I said before, are themselves, you know, if we get there, the Earth will still be damaged in some pretty serious ways, but it's a good thing to aim for. And those are that we want to halve our emissions from industry and energy every decade, which is quite a dramatic reduction given mm-hmm. that our emissions are currently growing. We need to totally zero out our emissions from land use, and we need to come up with some kind of what's called carbon capture technology, which are devices to extract carbon from the atmosphere to absorb twice as much carbon as is currently taken up by all of the world's plants. So I do think that there are, you know, I do think that I don't want to counsel despair. Personally, I feel hopeful, and I think that there, you know, this is all entirely within our control.
Mm-hmm.
But the you know, the urgency is very clear. The kinds of action that we need to take are very aggressive. And one of the main reasons that I was excited to publish this piece was to impress those facts upon an audience that I think had been to this point a little complacent. And to the broader question about fear and whether that's useful rhetorically, I just have to say, you know, anecdotally in my own life, this isn't scientific, but I just feel very strongly that complacency is a bigger problem than fatalism, that there are just many people who are not scared enough about climate change. And I just don't think there are that many people who are too scared of climate change, given the scale of the risks that we face.
Ed Maybach, professor and director of the Center for Climate Change Communication at George Mason University. Sadly, as we know, global warming is not just a matter of individual decisions, but of honestly, public policy and corporate decisions. What's the best way to make an impact in both of those hyper-cynical arenas?
Yeah, so coming back to sort of the way the average American sees this challenge, there are a lot more Americans who are motivated to do something than Americans who know what to do. We have sort of done a systematic study of how Americans think about this issue, what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what they're doing, and we've identified six distinct groupings out there in America. The one group who is most engaged in the issue, who is doing the most, we call them the alarmed segment. And virtually about 18% of the American adult population right now is alarmed about climate change. They understand it's happening. They understand it's human caused. They're very worried about it. And virtually 100% of them are changing their behavior. But the ways in which they're changing their behavior is really interesting. All of them are trying to shop differently, if you will. They're trying to change the way they spend money to buy the right products and to shop with the right, let's just say, the right shopkeepers, corporations who they believe are lining up behind solutions, and they're trying to withhold their consumer dollar from corporations who they think are still part of the problem. But only about one out of four of this group of very engaged Americans are actually using their voice as a citizen.
What about age? What about age?
Doesn't vary all that much by age, actually. No, you know, my kids are in their 20s, and my kids are pretty engaged in this issue. But people in their 20s in general are no more engaged than their parents or their grandparents. But it comes back to the issue of what can people do? And so we've got a fair number of Americans who are starting to act as consumers in a helpful way. There are a lot more Americans who would do that if they knew what to do, but we have a relatively small number of Americans who are engaging in the issue politically. And as has been said by almost everybody else in the show today, you know, political change is really how we're going to solve the problem. You and I don't care, you know, what the source of electricity is that's charging our cell phone right now, as long as it comes, you know, as long as it's reliable and we can afford it. But we certainly would prefer that the source of those electrons came from clean, renewable energy as opposed to dirty energy, mm-hmm. because we understand that dirty energy pollutes our air and our water, and nobody likes that.
Susan Matthews, science editor at Slate. When you listen to what Ed Maybach is describing, do you remain pessimistic that people may not take aggressive action even as things get worse? Are we failing in the effort as journalists, as narrators, even pop culture? We can bring that into the equation. Are we failing in the process of explaining how dangerous, if not a doomsday scenario, but how dangerous this truly is?
No, I don't think that. I think that one of the major criticisms of this piece has been that this piece didn't spend enough time on solutions and what people can do. But we live in the information age. People don't live in a vacuum. They can finish this New York Magazine piece and they can Google, what can I do about climate change? And they can start reading a lot more news coverage and service journalism and connect with a number of great advocacy groups who are working on this to understand. And so what I think, what they can do. So I think that when we talk about the fact that this might just depress people out of taking the next step, I actually think that there are a number of options and resources for people who are newly motivated to connect to this issue and to figure out how they can engage with it.
Where should they start?
I would say try to read more about the issue and what the actual solutions are and what the political stakes are. I mean, we live in a world where one political party doesn't even really admit that this is a concern worth addressing. And so educating yourself about your local politicians and their perspectives on this issue is really important. And when we say that climate change has become a polarized topic in society, but there are places all around the country that are actually starting to recognize this does have local effects and they are taking action. So I would say it starts with local effort and connecting there.
Let's go back to Robert Kopp, a climate scientist and professor and director of Rutgers University's Institute of Earth, Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. Bob, as a scientist, what do you recommend people personally and politically do to combat climate change? Will scientists weigh in ahead of the next presidential election? What can we expect from the scientific community, even when we think of honestly, narrative imagination on this particular topic?
Well, I mean, you know, I think as scientists, the community's primary goal has to be a trustworthy source of information. And I think it is fair to say that a lot of that information is alarming. We had a paper out in Science a couple of weeks ago, and we found that every degree Fahrenheit of warming that we allow to happen threatens the lives of about 10,000 Americans from the current population. And I think you see a lot of scientists raising their voices as private citizens being very concerned about this issue. But I also think as scientists, we have a responsibility to not alarm people by going beyond what the facts say, but by expressing alarm if we are alarmed based on what we can learn from studying the planet. And I think one of the things that's really important to realize that can sometimes get lost is that every little bit of reduction in warming helps. It's not like there's some magic threshold at 2 degrees Celsius, and if we go over it a tiny bit, there's no point in working to reduce emissions further. Every degree of warming causes more risks. It raises the threat of surprises that the scientific community doesn't expect. And so all the actions we can take to get this country and the world on a path towards a decarbonized energy system and decarbonized economy are helpful. Ultimately, to stabilize the planet's climate, we need to bring global carbon dioxide emissions down to zero. And that is a societal challenge. It's a political challenge, and it requires people to be active as citizens.
Let me go back to David Wallace Wells, the author of The Uninhabitable Earth, this very controversial and very successful story at New York Magazine. David, has all this surprised you? Have you been surprised by the reaction to the piece, and especially the comments that you get, even this discussion on the show? Or are you pleased with what you've accomplished?
I'm happy. Yeah, I would say, first of all, just in terms of readership, the story has been successful sort of beyond our wildest imaginations, and it's the most successful story that New York Magazine has ever published in terms of readers, which makes me suspect, I don't know other publications, history, that it's at least among the most successful climate stories in terms of readers ever published by any journalistic outfit. And I think that's an enormous and very exciting achievement, not for what it says about this article, but for what it says about climate coverage going forward. I think there's been a great reluctance among journalists, especially journalists at organizations that balance commercial interests with sort of earnest journalistic interests, to cover this seriously or aggressively. And I think in a certain way, this demonstrates that there is really an enormous audience for stories about climate change. I think that's very, very exciting. Most of the response that I've gotten from scientists has also been quite supportive. And both in emails and also in more public forums, I would say. Mm-hmm. Most of the people I interviewed, we've also published a series of my research interviews, and just a few moments before we got on the air, I should just mention we published also a fully annotated piece to show all of my work on this, mm-hmm. to answer some of the questions about the scientific basis for the claims that I made. There has been a sort of vocal critical response among certain climate scientists, and about that I want to be really careful, because these are people who I admire personally, whose work I hold in tremendous esteem.
Yes.
And I'm really doing, my goal, my aim in this project was really to bring their work and the work of people like them to the public. But I do think that much of the particular criticism has been a bit overstated.
Yes.
On that. I think that, I personally, your listeners can go to the annotated piece, as scientists can now do, and we can talk about some of the details.
Yes.
But on the sort of big picture question, I took the UN's median and high-end projection for a world without action on climate. I took those numbers, those temperature levels, to scientists. I asked them what it would mean for their field.
Yes, yes, yes.
I wrote up their answers, and then I ran those answers by them verbatim.
I think you would agree, and with me, as we both are journalists, it comes with the territory. It's been so successful, it had to happen. I personally congratulate you. I think that the success of your piece just shows that there's a need to say more and do more. Thank you, David Wallace Wells, Bob Cobb, Susan Matthews, and Ed Maybach. In a moment, the promise of a 2,000-mile wall along the border with Mexico has been at the center of Trumpism since the campaign. But this week, Donald Trump seemed satisfied with a much lesser version of the project. How's the design shaping up? You'll find out next on To The Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Leon Krause, here with today's talking point. Donald Trump's rise has a lot to do with one main selling point the president went back to again and again and again during last year's campaign.
Build that wall. 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 Build that wall.
But actually, building a 2,000-mile-long, 30-foot-tall border wall along the country's southern border is looking less and less likely. This week, the president downsized the project's grandiosity, saying it could be shorter and transparent. And even some potential contractors who bid on the project now doubt the wall will ever get built. Our next guest has been talking to some of those bidders. Ian David Vollner is a journalist and design critic. He recently wrote about this for Foreign Policy magazine in an article titled "Trump Doesn't Want a Winner for His Wall Competition." Ian, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So just remind us what the campaign pledge for a wall made the prototype sound like. Impossibly long, imposing, tall. What did it look like?
Yeah, the words that were most often affixed to it by the president and candidate were great and beautiful. The sensation was that it was going to be not merely effective, but a kind of most imposing edifice stretching straight from the Pacific Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
That now doesn't seem likely, as the president's comments this week made clear he'd begun to register the reality of.
It sounds more like a fence now. Trump talked to reporters on Air Force One this week, and he said, I'm quoting, "One of the things with the wall is you need transparency. You have to be able to see through it. In other words, if you can't see through the wall, so it could be a steel wall with openings, but you have to have openings because you have to see what's on the other side of the wall." Could you please translate that?
Many of the proposals that were submitted when the initial competition took place in March did indeed have some degree of transparency. Many of them, I'm thinking of one in particular, you could see south from the American side onto the Mexican, but not back. Certainly there's an argument from the security for reasons of being able to see what's going on the other side, but as described by the president, it doesn't necessarily reflect any of the likely outcomes or any of the ones seriously under consideration now.
Mm-hmm.
We simply don't know, and we won't know until the prototypes get under construction, something that was supposed to have begun last month, what the likely final product will be, if there ever is a final product.
Let's talk about the design process. Donald Trump has said he might want the wall to be a solar wall, solar panels. Some 200 companies submitted proposals. You say there are now some 20 companies being considered, but we only know of a few of them. So tell me about these companies.
The 20 companies now under consideration in what the Customs and Border Protection Division of the Department of Homeland Security is calling Phase 2 of the competition. These 20 supposedly will progress onto the prototype stage now, supposedly only within a matter of weeks. CBP made a curious maneuver. When it declared that the 20 firms had been selected, it did not make clear to the firms to whom it told that they were now moving forward whether or not they were allowed to talk to the media about their finalist status. Most of them got the very strong impression, it was clear enough from CBP, that they should not tell anyone that they were now under consideration, and so most have not come forward. But one did, shortly after the announcement. A subcontractor on a bid, his name is Dennis O'Leary, the firm is Dark Pulse Technologies. They supplied a fiber optic sensor system that's supposed to make their wall bid capable of detecting movement and things like this for better interdiction of cross-border traffic. In casting around among the 200 original submissions for my piece, I discovered another contractor, Riverdale Mills of Massachusetts. They are a maker of a proprietary wire mesh system primarily used in lobster and clam and oyster fishing. They also have substantial experience with wall construction, but those are the only two thus far who we know by name. A third spoke to me on the condition of anonymity.
I have a bunch of questions, but where will the money come from? And because this is a big issue, obviously. We're talking about billions of dollars, some say $20, $21, $22 billion. Where will the money come from for this hypothetical wall?
Indeed, it could be a great deal more than $21 billion. The Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Oversight, as I believe it is, the Senate Democratic Committee, released a figure some weeks ago that put the figure as high as $70 billion. That might be a bit hyperbolic, but it might not be either. The truth is that the $21 or $22 billion estimate, which was a leaked estimate from Homeland Security, does not take into account the likely cost of acquisition of land adjacent to the wall. If there are holdouts, and there are likely to be among landowners there, all of the legal proceedings that would then take place and all the negotiations and bidding to acquire those properties could send the price skyrocketing. So there is no sure amount how much it's likely to cost, and there is no source presently available to actually provide that money. The prototype construction, which should be underway shortly in the desert not far from San Diego, among the, well, it'll be less than the 20 current Stage 2 finalists. It will be as few as 4 or 8. That's going to cost around $20 million, and that is from money presently in possession of CBP that's been transferred over to this process. Even that money, says the anonymous finalist with whom I spoke, is not likely to do anything more than stop the bleeding that his firm has already incurred in trying to bid and participate in this process.
You think that Trump could end up building a 700 mile long fence as a sort of monument to his political base and call it a campaign pledge made good? Very different from an immense, big, 30 foot tall, 2,000 mile long border wall. Do you think that's likely?
You use the word monument, and I think that's the key word. It needn't even be 700 miles long. Any wall, any structure that he's likely to build, even just the prototype segments that are supposed to appear.
A statue of himself, maybe on the border? A statue of himself?
A statue of himself. Whatever's required for him to be able to have something to show to his base that the effort was made, something that he can claim is the wall itself or evidence of his earnestness in pursuing the project, will be enough to satisfy his base. Because as one finds in reading testimonials and speaking to wall supporters, there's a broad understanding that the wall was never going to be a full 2,000 miles, that the geographical and other logistical challenges would be too high.
Yes.
There was always an understanding that its primary operation would be symbolic, mm-hmm. that it would represent the will of a certain portion of the American electorate, a kind of angry gesture of protest against the, by now largely inevitable, transformation of the United States into a minority-majority country.
A monument to nativism. Thank you, Ian. It was a pleasure to talk to you. That was design writer Ian Vollner. His forthcoming book, Michael Graves, Design for Life, will be out this fall. And thank you. Thank you for being with us today. This is Leon Krause in for Warren Only. Join us again for To The Point, which is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.